This is Mary Richards. Because of technical mishaps during last week's airing of the Community Bookshelf, one program was begun twice, one was not heard at all. This week we are backing up and playing those segments in the correct order. That will mean that you will listen to one repeated segment, but please accept our apologies and bear with us. Enjoy the program. Hello, I'm Mary Richards, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf, which can be heard every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Hello, and welcome once again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. We are reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere by Deborah Marquardt. It was published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. As we rejoin the story, she is talking about forebears whom she never knew. My great-grandmother, Barbara Holm Marquardt, did not leave Russia by choice. I know that now. She left Kandel, her village on the steppes near the Black Sea, to follow my great-grandfather Joseph, who was on the run from forced induction into the Russian army. Historically, German Russians were a gentle people whose abilities blossomed in the presence of plants and animals. Over the centuries, they sought fertile, low-lying plains for their farming, the lush Rhine Valley of Central Europe in the 1700s. The rolling steppes of southern Russia in the 1800s. Unfortunately, these farmland plains were also ideal terrain to roll troops across, so we are the people whose crops have been trampled by every major despot and emperor who has tried to make a land grab on the continent of Europe. We Russo-Germans will never mold history. History will always roll violently over us. In old war novels and movies, look for us. We are the anonymous dead nobodies left to rot in the countryside, our pockets turned out, our shoes stolen, our faces bloodied to an unrecognizable pulp, while the hero destined for history books marches on to the capital city. For this reason, I find myself empathizing with the powerless at every turn. I scan the crowds of refugees on CNN, looking for faces that resemble those of my great-grandparents. Watching episodes of Star Trek, I grow anxious for the new crew member, the one who is not part of the permanent cast, when he is enlisted to join the away team. I know he will be the one to catch the incurable virus or be vaporized on Planet X, 10 million light-years away from home. In the same way, I have always felt sorry for Antigonus, the loyal but short-sighted lord in Shakespeare's The Winter Tale. Faithful to a fault, Antigonus delivers the baby girl child Perdita to the wild, stormy hillside where her father, the king, intends for her to perish. And with this loyal act, Antigonus terminates his usefulness to the plot. In fact, the story so requires that Antigonus not be alive to reveal the secret of how he disposed of Perdita, so the surprise is maximized later in the play when she appears fully grown, that the only thing for the playwright to do is kill him. Shakespeare disposed of him in the most economical way. Quote, Antigonus, exit, pursued by bear. The sight of that infamous stage direction saddens me. Reading this, I decide never to be useful to kings, never to hold their terrible secrets. Guns have never fit well in our hands, so molded to the scythe and the plow. To avoid a fight, we have several times picked up and moved to another continent. But every few generations, some of us are born angry or stubborn, Or perhaps as foolish as the miniature toy poodle I once observed, who was so yappy and bold that he barred me from passing him on a sidewalk. He didn't understand that even though he was barking with big poodle genes, in reality he was only a palm-sized dog. By all accounts, my great-grandfather Joseph Marquardt was such a person, a small man with big plans and lordly ambitions. Like Per Hanse in Rolvak's Giants in the Earth, he looked out on the unbroken grassland while his wife collapsed in tears beside him, and thought to himself, "I am going to do something remarkable out here, which should become known far and wide. This kingdom is going to be mine." For years, it seemed, I found my great-grandfather in every third novel I read. In Jane Smiley's A Thousand Acres, he's the land-hungry father, Larry Cook. In Willa Cather's O Pioneers, he's the land-loving settler, John Bergson, who even from the grave would have appreciated the look of a full field of grain, so heavy that it bends toward the blade and cuts like velvet. In William Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom, I found my great-grandfather in the character Thomas Sutpin, a stranger who appears in Yoknapatawpha County with a mysterious past, whose goal it is to possess 100 square miles of land and produce a solid lineage of children flowing out of him into the future. I found a reflection of myself in Absalom, Absalom, as the young, preoccupied Quentin Compson, listening, having to listen, to one of the ghosts, telling him about old ghost times. His very body was an empty hall echoing with sonorous defeated names. Quentin was not a being, Faulkner wrote. He was a commonwealth. My own constituency includes multiple layers of grandmothers buried in unmarked graves and complicated totems of grandfathers resting heavy on my shoulders, all of them waving subtle whiffs of stories before me, then telling me to construct the rest out of the fragments. On the morning of our proposed trip to Great-Grandma Marquardt's grave, after the repairmen arrived and the sprinkler once again demonstrated its proficiency in Sector C, we were off, heading south to the site of the original homestead of my great-grandfather. On the road, driving south of Napoleon on Highway 3, my parents were quiet in the car. They had turned on a country western music station, and my father tapped his fingers on the wheel to the beat. My mother hummed lightly. They both watched the landscape go by, pointing things out, making elliptical comments that I couldn't decipher from the back seat. My parents were consummate observers of the landscape. What were the hundreds of things they knew about this place that I could not see? Drainage patterns, the knowledge of crops that would thrive here, signs of erosion, names of wildflowers, grasses, and trees. Driving south, we passed through the moraine of rocky hills left by the last glacier. Tucked inside the ridges and slopes were farms, clusters of houses, barns, outbuildings, grain silos, cattle grazing in green fields, farm equipment parked at random angles in grassy yards, cultivated farmland spreading out for miles. Many of my friends from high school grew up on these farms. As we passed each one, my parents updated me on recent history, which son took over the farm, who he married, what became of the rest of the kids. After a long alienation from that place, I wanted to see it again as my parents did, as a variegated, complex thing, a place to spend one's whole life studying and loving. For many years, I felt an aversion from home, an overpowering flight impulse, upon which I believed my very survival depended. But now, I can recall blissful days of early childhood on that land. In fourth grade, We were given an assignment to identify trees by collecting their leaves and classifying them. After school that day, I remember walking the long rows of the orchard that bordered our farm on the hunt for leaves. Our family always called this five-row band of trees the orchard, even though, aside from chokecherries, it never contained fruit-bearing trees. It was a tree belt, frankly, a wind shelter for the farm. Great-grandpa must have called it the orchard, an indicator of the grandiosity of his dreams for us, and perhaps some trace memory of the estates that he recalled from his childhood in Russia. Now I can recall my rapture on that warm fall afternoon, walking through the protected rows, the cloistered quiet, the sound of birds, the light breeze, the sun coming through the branches and touching my face in strobes of light. I must have completed the school assignment. I have a vague memory of pressing the leaves into a small book with a cool iron and wax paper. But that day is the last memory I have of being unequivocally happy in the natural world. After that, all my associations with the land are of hard work, the incessant wind, chores, lifting, sweating, feeling exposed in weather that was too hot or too cold. Very soon, I retreated into the antiseptic world of books. My attentions migrated to the more pleasant things of the world. Music, television, fashion. I was hijacked by popular culture. But now, as I approach my 50s and live hundreds of miles away, I want nothing more than to find, once again, that blissful place on family land, wandering happily through rows of trees on a sunny fall afternoon. We found my great-grandmother's cemetery easily enough. Inside the lace of iron in tall letters was the name of the now defunct church, St. Andrew's Parish. The old church was boarded up, but the graveyard was well maintained. The summer had been warm and dry, so the grass was bristly under my sandals. We passed through the gate that opened under an ominous wrought iron archway. Her grave was marked with an iron cross, a tradition among German Russians. In the early days of settlement, the blacksmith served a dual role in the village, one pragmatic, the other artistic. He was called on to build an iron cross grave marker out of spare shafts and curlicues of iron. These iron crosses, which are sprinkled in Catholic German Russian graveyards throughout the Dakotas, are now historically preserved. So we found that my great-grandmother's grave marker had been painted with silver paint to protect it from deterioration. I stood with my parents in the warm sun and looked down at the name on the small plate. Barbara Marquardt, 1861-1900. I milled around the graveyard with my parents. Having found her and visited her, we didn't know what else to do. If a trip to an abandoned cemetery was not sobering enough, near my great-grandmother's grave on the edge of St. Andrew's Parish Cemetery, we found an even more devastating sight. A row of identical iron crosses, seven in total. When we studied the nameplates, we learned the reason for their uniformity. Six of the names were of children, all with the same surname, who had died within days of each other. Within 1 week in 1918, it appeared from looking at the vintages, this family had lost six children ranging in ages from 12 to 2. The grave on the end, the seventh, was that of an older woman in her 30s, with the same family name, who died 1 year later, in 1919. Was she the mother who died of grief within a year after losing her children? It's hard not to construct a narrative around such a sight. My father bent down and ran his fingertips across the letters on the steel plates marking the grave. "It must have been the flu epidemic," he said. Even though it happened a few years before he was born, he found it hard to believe that he didn't know the story. The row of graves indicates a scope of tragedy that usually carries a story that people for miles around would remember and talk about for years to come. Oh, yes, that was the Schmidt family, all wiped out in 1918. How do dramatic stories get lost in families? About my grandparents' passage to America, my father could not tell me even the smallest detail. From my cousin Tony, I learned the skeleton of the story. When my great-grandfather was a young man in Kandel, he was of the first generation of German colonists to be drafted into the Russian military. I don't know how my great-grandfather was inducted, although I have heard stories from other families of Russian military convoys arriving in the villages late at night, going door to door, and demanding from each household one young man to serve. I have heard of women hiding their sons in the rafters, knowing that young men rarely returned whole, if they returned at all. And I have also heard of those Russian soldiers stepping into the houses and firing their weapons through the roofs of houses to discourage the practice of hiding sons in rafters. I do not know in which wars, if any, my great-grandfather fought, or if he could shoot a weapon, or if he ever killed a man. It's only from his obituary that I learned he rose somehow to the rank of officer. But Tony remembered great-grandpa telling the story of how he was smuggled out of South Russia. "In der Dunkelheit," is the phrase Tony says great-grandpa always used. Under cover of darkness. I asked Tony what could have caused him to run away, to risk leaving behind his family, his wife and children, all his property, all the people of his village. Around the slim remnants of this story, there were, no doubt, many heart-pounding moments of terror and exhilaration. But these have all dropped away over the last 120 years. The short answer, the only known detail that remains, is that one day my great-grandfather flew into a rage and struck a commanding officer, a Feldmarschall, as Tony recalled the title, a Russian field marshal. What could have possessed my great-grandfather to lose all concern for self-preservation and strike a powerful Russian superior? This act is not consistent with what I know about my meek and evasive ancestors. With this detail, I must come to terms with either how principled and irrepressible he was, or how foolish and impulsive he may have been. Did a court-martial or the firing squad await him at daybreak? My great-grandfather survived his act of insubordination with the help of a fellow officer, also a German. The German superior must have been powerful to accomplish the things that I know from the family story happened next. My great-grandfather was smuggled that night out of the country and eventually made his way to Bremen, Germany, where he spent several months waiting for my great-grandmother and their children to follow. I try to imagine my great-grandfather riding away from the night sounds of a soldier's camp somewhere in the middle of Russia in 1885. He moves silently, as if floating on an invisible river, and as he rides, the sound of the army diminishes, becomes softer and softer until all he can hear is the sound of his horse, the clapping of hooves on the dark path. So nice for him, a farmer by inclination and trade, to be back in the presence of pure nature. Perhaps he carries a sack with a few small potatoes in it, a pinch of salt. Does he stop by the side of the road to eat and draw some water from a stream? Maybe he has a companion to help him across the border. Maybe he is alone. He sits down by the creek and listens to the wind moving through the trees, feels the cool grass beneath him. He is tired and a bit stunned by the events that have transpired in the last 24 hours. He thinks of his wife, my great-grandmother, and of his three small children back in the village on the Dniester River, just north of the Black Sea. Will he ever see them again? Will he see his mother and father, the church where he was married, the school where he taught before he was drafted? Before him in the long night are only unknowns and a silence that stretches out into the darkness. For this moment, I want to think of my great-grandfather as simply a young man, as uncertain of his future as I am in my own life each day. He is sitting in the dark by a creek, eating stale bread, on the run from the Russian military. For this moment, he is simply a traveler, out of all place and time. None of the assurance of the photographs he will take later in life in America is with him now. When we look at our ancestors in pictures, it's easy to think of them as people whose lives are settled, written, complete. We imagine they lived in simpler times. But behind those sober, unsmiling faces, behind those formal black clothes, one can be certain there was great suffering. A woman's pinched mouth betrays a lifetime of anger against her husband. A child's hunched shoulders indicate he's itchy and uncomfortable in new clothes. A husband's confused expression reveals that he wonders why his wife produces all these daughters and so few sons. In that dark night, does my great-grandfather tear off a piece of bread, try to calm himself by eating it? He is 29 years old. Beside him on the ground is a small, olive-colored wool blanket he will sleep on for the night. Close to him in the dark, chewing and snuffling, is the horse he will ride to the border. He realizes he has just committed the most brilliant or the most stupid act of his life, and right now he has no idea which it is. The only thing to do is lay his head down on the blanket, feel his heartbeat, listen to the stream move in the darkness, and know that he is as alone, helpless, and as untethered in the world as he has ever been. The ground beneath his sleeping head is some of the most well-traveled and consistently inhabited land in the world. The Great Pontic Steppe, which throughout time has been the contact zone for groups as diverse as the Kurgan people, the Scythians, who traveled in nomadic packs across the steppes from Siberia, and the Sarmatians, another nomadic Indo-Iranian group. According to Neil Asherson's Cultural and Natural History, Black Sea, the land where my great-grandfather lays his head on this quiet night in 1885 has been home to a succession of settlers. Tatar villages, colonies of Russian veteran soldiers and their descendants, Polish exiles, neat farming districts where almost everyone was German, Cossack stanitsas, and Jewish shtetls. Before that, this was home to Greeks, Thracians, the Prussians, Armenians, and the Moldovans, all in their own time. West of here, near the Dniester Liman, the widening of the river that flows by the village where my great-grandmother sleeps peacefully for this one last night, is the ruins of the ancient colony of Tiras, surrounded by the huge Turkish fortress of Akkerman, now partly buried by the waters of the encroaching Black Sea. This is the place in Russia my ancestors dared to call home. How did the German colonists come to believe, a mere 75 years into their inhabitation of these villages, that they belonged so completely to the steppe? In retrospect, it makes them seem naive, but I understand their feeling of surety. When I was a child growing up in North Dakota, with only 75 years of family land ownership to inform and assure me. I could not imagine a time when my hometown, Napoleon, would not be there. Both of my grandfathers had been born in Russia, both of my grandmothers in America. We had old roots to one country and new roots in another. What caused me to believe that someone of my blood would always live on our land? Yet I never doubted it. There is a comfort in that knowledge, the effects of which cannot be easily described or assessed. Never let the land go out of the family. This is a caution I heard often and always growing up. As the owners of the Center Farm, the original homestead, my family has been the caretaker of a legacy that's important, if only conceptually, to cousins and uncles and aunts who live in places far and wide. On the day of my father's funeral, this was the one thing that my brother heard again and again. Don't sell the land. Our adult cousins shook my brother's hand and clapped his shoulder. If it ever comes down to it, let me know so I can buy it. These were dentists and teachers, insurance salesmen and owners of construction firms who lived three states away. These were people who had never spent one day on the land that is our family farm. Still, the land represented terra firma to them, some deeper sense of home. What makes a piece of land go solid under your feet? How to explain this nostalgia for land that overtakes otherwise pragmatic people? Mircea Eliade wrote in The Myth of the Eternal Return that archaic man saw settled land as sacred and the wilderness as profane. Wilderness or uncultivated regions were part of the undifferentiated void, something to be shaped and molded to our needs. When our ancestors performed rites of cultivation such as plowing, seeding, and finally inhabiting a piece of land, they saw themselves as cosmicizing it, making it sacred by matching its shape to the cosmic model. According to Eliade, people who settled virgin land found themselves to be performing an act of creation. Like God, they were doing elemental things, separating the light from the dark, the land from the ocean. They were making order from chaos. At that moment, no matter how difficult the work, they felt their lives take on a greater resonance. Their actions connected them to ancient, ongoing patterns, what Eliade described as a ceaseless repetition of gestures, and they felt their connection to a chain of being that stretched back beyond known ancestors. Family land, by association, becomes a symbolic locus, a geographical record of those sacrifices and successes. From the few words I have to remember my great-grandmother by, it's all earth and sky. I can't say whether she lived long enough to feel that sense of belonging or accomplishment. Maybe she knew the place would destroy her. In Giants in the Earth, Rolvak's character Per Hansa observes about his wife, Berit. She has never felt at home here in America. There are some people, I know now, who never should emigrate, because, you see, they can't take pleasure in that which is to come. They simply can't see it. My great-grandmother's trip with three small children from Odessa, Russia, to Bremen, Germany, by rail, then to America by boat, then pregnant across the country to Dakota Territory by train, and finally to her homestead by oxen, must have felt like some weird regression. It was as if she were traveling back in time, a reversal and undoing of her own grandparents' trek from the Rhine Valley east along the Danube River to Russia in 1803. And this is going to be a good place for us to stop our reading today of The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, a memoir written by Deborah Marquardt, who is professor at Iowa State University and the coordinator of the creative writing program there. This program is produced by Mary Richards, assistant producer Janet Kloss, program engineer Ron Latson, and chief engineer Rick Morrison. You can listen to the KHOI Community Bookshelf every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday evening at this time. Give us comments or suggestions at 515-292-2878 or khoiradio@gmail.com. This is Mary Richards. Thanks very much for listening. You have been listening to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. This is Mary Richards. Thanks very much for listening.